Good morning, everybody. Glad to see all of you here. Hope all of you have had a good week and are ready to dive back into some history. And we're going to cover still a lot of ground again today. Could somebody flip this set of lights off over here? There you go. Thank you. Hopefully with our new projector over here, this will be a little clearer than it has been in the past. So for those of us who are older, maybe make it a little easier to see. Do what? I was. Yeah. I wasn't excluding myself. Okay, look, we're going to start this morning. We're going to talk about a man named Charlemagne. Hopefully all of you have heard of Charlemagne. Maybe fewer of you have heard about Pope Leo III, but these two men were contemporaries, and we're going to talk a little bit about how these two men fit together. As you can see in this picture here on the right, Charlemagne, what is he carrying?
Sword.
What is that representative of? Sword of the state. Man on the right, Pope Leo, what does he have? It's hard to see, but can you see what he has in his left hand?
It's like a gun.
Not exactly. Can you tell? Anybody can tell? They're keys. What are they the keys to? The kingdom. So we have two different kingdoms represented here, basically. You have the secular kingdom, and you have a sacred kingdom. And how do these two fit together? And that's what we're going to talk about this morning. And as we've been talking over the last couple of Sundays, more and more you see the Roman Empire and the church begin to come together. And we'll talk a little bit more about that, but hopefully you've got in your mind kind of how these things are coming together. But we'll talk a little bit more about that as we move forward. But first of all, we want to recover just a little bit of ground for review as far as what's happened. Where are we going? History of theology in the Christian church. We're going to do a little bit of a recap. Then we're going to talk about the history of the secular government, the Roman Empire from the 2nd century up to the 9th century. And the history of leadership in the Christian church and the development of the episcopacy. So we're going to talk about those three things. First thing we're going to do is talk about theology. We've already talked about from 45 to 399 the canonization of the New Testament. We did two lessons on that, one on the Old Testament, one on the New Testament. Then we talked about the first council of Nicaea. We've talked briefly about Constantinople and Ephesus. Then we talked about the Council of Chalcedon. Then we've talked, there are two others, the Constantinople in 553, 681 Constantinople, and then a second council of Nicaea in 787. And one of the things that came out of the second council of Nicaea was an approval by the council for the veneration of icons and of saints. And if we have time, we can talk a little bit more about that in part of our discussion. But for right now, just know that that's one of the things that came out of that council. Now, what has developed over the time that we've been talking about? Basically, the doctrine of Scripture. We've looked at the canon of the New Testament and some of the things that came against that, the Gnosticism that occurred in the 2nd through the 4th centuries. Then we have theology proper, or the doctrine of God. We have Christology, the doctrine of Christ, and pneumatology, the doctrine of the Holy Spirit. We've talked about the Trinitarian controversy in the 4th century and the Christological controversy in the 5th century. So we've been working our way forward, and as the church grows and matures, you begin to see how these developments are taking place in doctrine as well. And again, anthropology, the doctrine of man, the Pelagian controversy in the 5th and the 7th centuries. We didn't talk much about it, but remember we talked about Pelagius and we talked about Augustine. and how that controversy helped develop this doctrine. So you see these things as they come against the church, that the church has to react to these heresies that come about and decide, okay, what do we really believe about God, about man, about Christ? And that's how these doctrines came about, and that's what we look back to today.
And that debate was really over the question of how much work does a man play in his own salvation? Yes. And the reason why that's a question of anthropology is not because it's the man who does the work. It's the question of, can a man do any work? So when you dig down into anthropology and you find out, well, what does the Bible really say about man? Well, it says, dead in his sins and trespasses. No one seeks God. No, not even one. That's a doctrine of anthropology. And then when you apply that to salvation, if the question is, how much work does a man do in saving himself? And something that you already know is, man is completely dead and doesn't seek God. Then any solution to how a man gets saved that involves man doing something can't work. So that's why anthropology was such a big deal for 300 years, was this debate of, all right, we've got the idea of who God is and what salvation is, but what's our part to play? What do we do? And if you start there with what do I think I do, you'll come out with a real man-centered salvation. But if you start with a good doctrine of anthropology, what am I capable of doing? The answer is nothing. And then it seems like it would have helped the process a little bit. Pelagius had just started there.
Yeah, and a lot of people try to split the baby because you have semi-Augustinianism, semi-Pelagianism, but any time you get away from man doing anything, that's when the train begins to come off the rails. So next we're going to move to a discussion of secular government. And I'm going to take a look at a map here. A map that everybody's seen before. But I want to take just a few minutes to review a little bit with you here. As you can see, this is, as we've said before, this is the apex of the Roman Empire around the 2nd century. As you can see, it goes all the way from Britain, all the way down to Palestine, across the top of Africa, up through Spain, what's now France, Italy, and down through Greece. And here's Byzantium, which eventually became Constantinople. You have Ephesus, Nicaea up in here, Antioch, Alexandria. Those are some places we should be familiar with now because we've discussed them a lot and how they have played a role in the church. Now, here is the might of the Roman Empire and the vast territories that it claimed. And eventually, Christianity, which started right there, eventually encompassed this whole Roman Empire. But at the same time it was ascending, the Roman Empire was descending. It was basically collapsing. And part of the persecution against the Christians, remember we said some of the Roman emperors did the persecution against the Christians to try and reunite the empire, to give them a common enemy. That was part of the thing. And then Constantine came along and he kind of did 180 and said, well, maybe the other way to go is to embrace the Christianity and use it to try and unite the empire. And that's kind of how this got started. Then you have the rise of the bishop in Rome as opposed to the other bishops throughout Christendom. For example, we've talked about Hippo, we've talked about Alexandria, Antioch, all the various bishops that were at these places, but eventually the Roman bishop grew to be over those other guys. And we'll talk a little bit later in this presentation about how that happened. But first of all, I just wanted you to kind of get in your mind here and especially look at what's now France, this area right here, because we're going to focus on this today. After we get through here, we're going to see how the Roman Empire declined, but then we have something called the Holy Roman Empire that grew to take its place, that came about. But I want you to kind of get fixed in your mind this area of France up here. Here's Italy there, and here's Constantinople over here. And this purplish area over here, That is the Eastern Roman Empire, and over here is the Western Roman Empire. So keep those, this map in your mind as we move forward. Now, anyone ever heard the saying that history tends to repeat itself? I want you to think about that as we go through here. What were some of the causes for the fall of the Roman Empire? Antagonism between the Senate and the Emperor. Et Brute. A decline in morals. Adultery, prostitution, every sexual perversion you can think of, and some maybe you can't even imagine. Massive consumption of alcohol and sadistic cruelty to men and to animals. Political corruption. Same old, same old. Fast expansion of the empire. What came out of that? Higher taxes, and they were constantly being increased. Constant wars and heavy military spending. With the geographically immense area that we were just looking at, you can imagine how much it took to try and hold all of that together militarily, especially with all of these invading forces around the outside that were constantly trying to attack Rome. Barbarian knowledge of Roman military tactics. I thought this was quite interesting. The barbarians and mercenaries, because the area was so big, they had to bring people into the army to help fill the army's ranks in order to defend the empire. But when they brought these non-Romans into the system, they learned how the Romans worked. A failing economy. Now listen to this. The government was constantly threatened by bankruptcy due to the cost of defending the empire. The failing economies, heavy taxation, and high inflation were other causes. The majority of the inhabitants of the Roman Empire failed to share in the incredible prosperity of Rome. The amount of gold sent to the Orient to pay for luxury goods led to a shortage of gold to make Roman coins. Eventually, Roman currency was devalued to such an extent that a system of bartering returned to one of the greatest civilizations the world had ever known. Unemployment of the working classes. Is any of this ringing a bell? They had cheap slave labor. As they conquered these lands, they had a bunch of slaves that they brought in to do the work. And people began to stop doing work. And get this, the plebes, I think that's the way you pronounce it, P-L-E-B-S. They were the general body of free land-owning Roman citizens who became dependent on handouts from the state. The Romans attempted a policy of unrestricted trade, but this led to the plebes being unable to compete with foreign trade. The government was therefore forced to subsidize the working-class Romans to make up the difference in prices. This resulted in thousands of Romans choosing just to live on the subsidies. The massive divide between the rich and the poor increased still further. The mob and the cost of the games. It's appropriate today we have the Super Bowl Sunday, right? Now this is interesting. The games, the Roman games. Now, even remember we talked a little bit about the, part of the games were, you know, throwing the Christians to the lions, but the games actually continued on up to about the time of Constantine. They actually had Roman games, although they didn't throw Christians to the lions anymore. They still would have gladiator games and chariot races and all kinds of things, and these were big deals. I mean, these were really big deals, and you'll see that in just a minute. The games were needed to amuse the masses of unemployed Romans. It was paid for by the government, which eventually came to one-third the total income of the empire to pay for the games. Now, they did make a consolation, though, that one of the emperors in 469 decided that they couldn't do games on Sunday. So they did make a, you know, a tip their hat towards the Christians. Decline in ethics and values. Thought this was interesting. Life became cheap. Bloodshed led to more bloodshed and extreme cruelty. The basic principles, standards, and judgments about what was valuable or important in life declined. A perverted view of what was right and wrong, good and bad, desirable and undesirable. Any conformity to acceptable rules or standards of human behavior were lost. Slave labor. Anybody ever see the movie Spartacus? That's where this was all taking place. The slaves were beginning to revolt against the empire. And this was interesting. Christianity. How did Christianity really become a part of the fall of the Roman Empire? Christianity made many Roman citizens into pacifists, making it more difficult to defend against the barbarian attackers. Also, money to build the churches, people were saying, we should have used that for the empire and for the roads and the infrastructure instead of for the churches. Natural disasters. There were plagues. As we mentioned, remember a week or so ago, we were talking about the various plagues that kept recurring. Famines and earthquakes.
Volcanoes. Pompeii.
Yeah. And then the barbarian invasions. Remember we've talked about all the various hordes that came against the Roman Empire and began to chip away at it. And eventually went down, as we said last time, into Rome and conquered it finally in 476. Again, does history repeat itself? Time will tell. Now, we've looked at this map before. This is about, that shows the invasions from 100 to 500. All of those attacking, coming in either from Carthage and coming in from here, the Huns, coming all the way over to Chalon. You have the Angles and Saxons up here. You have the Franks. Now, these guys right here are going to play an important part in our discussion here in just a few minutes. But these Franks up here come into what's now France, which in your mind, hopefully that links up with modern-day France. But do you notice something initially? That there's not that much activity over here in the eastern part of the empire. But all of this is occurring over in the west. Remember, Constantine had moved the capital over to Constantinople, away from Rome. And they basically had kind of ignored what was going on in the west. They really couldn't do much to defend it. So the west actually began to crumble. Now, after a lot of these attacks, this is kind of what the Roman Empire had shrunk to. Here's the east, which is at this moment is pretty much still intact. But you notice the west over here, just this piece here and up in here. Now that's as of 476, when, remember I said Rome was actually taken down by the invaders. Then you have the Muslim conquest. We've talked about this one before as well. And you see how quickly this happened from 622 to 750. They've taken basically all of North Africa, most of what we now know as the Middle East, and even into Spain. This whole area is now Islamic. And as you can see, this small area here and this area up in here is all that's really left of the Eastern Roman Empire and of the Eastern Church, the Eastern Orthodox. Now, next Sunday, we're going to talk about an eventual split in the church between the East and the West. So that's what we're going to talk about next week. But just for now, keep in mind, again, this whole map in here. So now you have this whole area down here that is Islamic. You have just a little sliver in Italy and a couple places up in here. It's basically all that's left of the Western Roman Empire. So now we're going to turn our cites here to the rise of the Frankish Empire. And, whoops, let me back up here. This area right in here is what we now know as modern-day France. And later on, this area is going to get split up between various people and descendants of the various kings. But for right now, just look at these areas. This eventually will become France. This area eventually becomes Germany and Poland and Switzerland and Austria and all these other things. So basically you have these Germanic tribes that are going down into France. We don't typically think of Germany and France. We think of them fighting each other. That came about later. But essentially these areas were conquered by these Germanic tribes that were up in here. So, the rise of the Gauls, that area in France that we're talking about. Caesar had originally conquered Gaul in the first century, and what he did, he basically, because he conquered this area, most areas that they went into, they tried to assimilate the people into the Roman culture and the Greek language. Remember, the Greek language and the Roman roads were part of the basis that Christianity used to spread its message throughout the Roman Empire. Around 466, a man named Clovis became leader of the Franks. He was the founder of what's called the Merovingian dynasty. It's easy for you to say. He was the first leader to really unify the Franks. As you can remember that map I just showed you, there were all kinds of little people out there, little individual groups that were conquering. He was one of the first to really bring all of them together. He was a real warrior. In 496, Clovis converted to Christianity. Remember we talked last time about the monastic movement and the missions that were going out from the church and how they began to convert the pagans. Now keep in mind, I want you to think about this. Christianity started in a little place in Palestine, eventually took over the entire Roman Empire, and now is also impacting all of these tribes that have, these Germanic pagan tribes that have come in and attacked it. And typically when a country would attack another country and take it over, its customs and its religion became what the people adopted, not the other way around. So I hope that you keep in mind as we go through all of this that you see God's superintending hand over all of His history and the message of His gospel going to all these people, even to this day, to this very day. So that's an overarching thing that hopefully you're seeing in this history, the thing that's connecting all of this together. As a result, Frankish leaders who followed Clovis protected the papacy. Because he became a Christian, he then turned around and protected the papacy. And this is something here, and gave it territories. I'm sure all of you have heard over the years about the immense wealth that the Catholic Church has had at, you know, many points in its history. This is kind of the beginning of it. Here you have the church that's coming along and pretty much been persecuted and poor, and now all of a sudden it's leading, almost leading the country because the secular leaders have been on a decline. They've been overpowered, but yet the church still existed. In God's grace and mercy, He still maintained His church in the midst of this. And then they began to get territories. This is part of the accumulation of the wealth. And it held it for over 1,000 years. Unfortunately, as what often happens in families, you have a strong leader, but eventually the sons do not follow in the footsteps of the father. They're either not as strong or don't have the military capability or whatever the reason might be, but the history doesn't tend to go on this way. And another thing, too, is the Germanic tribes had something in the way that they would pass on territory. For example, when Clovis converted to Christianity and had conquered all these lands, if he had multiple sons, when he died, what would normally happen is, unlike the Jewish tradition where it would be passed to the eldest son, his holdings would be split between all of his heirs. So you have this, you know, splitting that would go on generation after generation and eventually would break down this central authority. So that's kind of what you have going on. Clovis was the end of the Merovian, that dynasty. Okay. A man named Charles Martel came along. He was called Charles the Hammer. Not because he carried a hammer, but because he was like a hammer on an anvil, the way he attacked all of the people who were surrounding. And he began to bring the Gauls back together again, where Clovis's descendants had allowed it to kind of break apart. Charles Martel brought these back together. Now, this right here, in 732, he defeated the Muslims. That is huge. Huge in the history of not only the Roman Empire, but of Christianity. It is, I saw this in many books, they called it a macro-historical event. What happened? Because if you remember, I was showing you the Muslims, how they're all across North Africa, coming up into France and coming up this way. The Byzantines over here at Constantinople were able to at least hold the Muslims from coming up any further than they already had. But they were coming up through France and through Spain into France, and actually would have gone on down into Italy had this not occurred. And fortunately for, they were able to stop the Muslims at that point. Now, Charles had a son called Pepin the Short. He continued to assist the papacy. See, the papacy was dependent upon the king to defend the church now. So the two were kind of fitting together. You see the closer movement of the two together. They kind of each depended on each other, because the emperor depended on the church to kind of keep the people in line with the religion and that sort of thing. But the church depended on the state to wield the sword to keep the peace.
Right.
Yes, sir.
The church we keep talking about here, how close is that to us in believing, and when did that church veer away from what we believe now?
It's all pretty close to what we believe. Mm-hmm. You'll see some minor divisions next week when the East and West split. But it's really a few hundred years after this. It's really as you approach the 1000 to 1500 period,
right,
that doctrine is intentionally bad. Sometimes here you have to remember, their doctrine is not as refined. The church isn't as old as we are now. So there were things that we would say now are really important that haven't even been articulated yet. That doesn't mean that they're wrong. It means they haven't gotten to that yet. But we would still have been a part of this church here.
Okay. Yes. Thank you.
Probably the biggest controversy that was coming about at this time was about icons, the iconoclastic thing, where you had emperors that would rise up that would be against the veneration of icons, and then you would have another king who would come up who would be for them. And it kind of went back and forth. And so that was one of the big things at that time. But basically, otherwise, doctrine, it was pretty close. And then Pepin the Short had a son named Charlemagne. And hopefully everybody, at least in your secular history, has heard of Charlemagne. You probably haven't heard his connection to the church, but at least you've heard of Charlemagne. And he lived from 742 to 814. Now, what you see here is Charlemagne, who is the man kneeling here, having a crown placed on his head by Pope Leo III. Now, at this point, the Roman emperor was in Constantinople. The thing that's different about this is the first time that a Western Roman Emperor existed, because previously it was all done in Constantinople. They were the Roman Empire. But Leo took it upon himself to crown Charlemagne. So, of course, Charlemagne was very happy that they did that. He said he didn't really want it, but he really did. But here you have the church now blessing the state. In other words, it's giving its sanction to the state and saying, this is the man, this is the one you should follow, and we're going to work together, church and state. This is a big deal. This is the start of what became known as the Holy Roman Empire. Previously it was the Roman Empire, now you have the Holy Roman Empire. But you see the beginnings of this mixture of church and state, and we're still dealing with it today. It doesn't go away. There's always this balance between the church and the state. Okay, what kind of questions come up? How did the Pope come to have power enough to crown a Roman emperor? How had the king of the Franks risen to a position to be so crowned? And how did this new relationship between the Pope and the greatest ruler of Northern Europe shape the centuries-long period? The second one there, how did the king rise to the position to be so crowned? We already talked about that. We've just gone through that secular history. What did it signify? It represented a strategic alliance between the papacy and the political power. It set the tone for the papacy for the next 800 years. Yes, sir?
It's been a while since I've studied this, but Charles the Hammer's son was Charlemagne?
Charles what?
Grandson. Okay.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Okay. It afforded the church physical protection. It gave the government the blessings of the church, like I said. So who was Charlemagne? He was physically imposing. I read it that he was somewhere between 6.5 and 7 feet tall. And for that day, that was big. He was a big man. Very imposing. He was a very religious man. He was a very successful man of war. He spread Christianity wherever he conquered it, whether you wanted it or not. See, that was the thing. When you had the state and the church mixed together, again, like I said, that was part of the thing. You went and conquered somebody, they took your customs, and you basically put your religion upon them. So you kind of got everybody together and said, okay, you're all now Christian. Now, that doesn't mean that there weren't real Christians that came out of these things. God still has his remnant of people. But you can see what might happen when you come in and just bring all these non-believers into the church. Of course, we don't do that today, do we? He was not well educated initially, but this man started a school. Not only he started schools in the monasteries, he started school even in his own court, and he attended his own school. He brought men in from Britain to teach in the schools. He tried to get his people to learn. He was a great administrator. So his empire grew, and he was able to control it. He really had a great administrative capability, and he was a friend of the church. They continued to give money and support and territories to the church, and the church continued to grow in its wealth. The Carolingian succession. Charlemagne had a son, Louis the Pious. His other sons died, so he didn't split his territories. But under his son, Louis had three sons. Lothair, Charles the Bald, and Louis the German. Now, there was a treaty called the Treaty of Verdun. These three brothers started fighting each other over the territories. So they were trying to bring some peace here. So they had a treaty in Verdun in 843, and they split the empire. Lothair over here took this area. And remember that area of Gaul that I was talking about? He got a strip that kind of went down the middle. He sort of had this strip that went right through the middle there. Louis the German got the east part. And this eventually became the German Empire. So think about that whole area we were talking about, that big green area. Right down the middle is Lothair. Then Louis the German is out here. And then you have Charles the Bald. And he was over the area of what became France. All right, quickly, history of the Christian church. 362, movement away from Jerusalem. After 363, Christianity finally became the state religion. In 381, Christianity became the exclusive religion of the state. 392, paganism was prohibited and became a punishable offense. 405, Jerome completes the translation of the Bible into the Latin Vulgate. And 476 to 800, the church attempts to fill the void and evangelizes the barbarians. Do you see on this slide the progression of the church and the state? I know it covers a long period of time, but I want you to, if you don't remember anything else, remember how this all comes together.
It's kind of a dumb question, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
Go ahead.
Were we supposed to believe that Pope Leo III and Charlemagne were both Christians? Or either one were?
It's hard to
tell. It's speculation.
Yeah, you're basing it off of history books, but there's pretty good fruit from both of them.
Yeah. Leo III was a pretty good theologian, from what I understand.
But you know, it's all off of history books.
Yeah. Yeah. What good came out of it? Orthodox Christianity was articulated, defended, and committed to writing, just like that we were talking about the various doctrines that came about as a result of that. The form of worship was refined. Sacred music was broadened. We talked about the Gregorian chants last time. It raised the moral tone of society. The dignity of women was raised. Women were not highly valued in any of these cultures at that time.
And that's a big issue, Bernard, because that's one of the most popular modern farces about the history of the world,
right,
is that Christianity has suppressed women, mm-hmm, and women were held in extremely high esteem outside of Christianity. And they always point back to, you know, Egyptian goddesses and Cleopatra. It's a bunch of nonsense.
It is.
There's no force on the planet has done more for the dignity and equality of women than Christianity.
Absolutely.
Just don't read anything written in the last 10 years and expect to find that.
Slaves were given milder treatment. The Roman legislation became more just. And the spread of missionary work was speeded up. Christianity has always favorably impacted areas like where did hospitals come from? Where did orphanages come from? Those things eventually came as a result of Christianity seeping into society. And sometimes there were bad results, but not in this particular case. What price did the church pay? The state demanded the right to interfere in the spiritual and theological matters. It was the beginning of the struggle for power between church and state. Mass conversions brought many professors of the faith into the church. And this is the sad part right here. It often became a persecutor of others the same way it had been persecuted. In some cases, even worse. And we'll talk about that next week. So now we're going to talk about the history of the leadership of the church. What is episcopacy? Form of church governance that is hierarchical in structure, with the chief authority over the local Christian church resting in a bishop. We've already talked a lot about that, about the various bishops in Antioch and Alexandria, Jerusalem. Episcopal structure is found in many churches, including Roman Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, Anglican, or others. The development of the episcopacy, first century, elder bishops and deacons, this is from the New Testament. So there's a biblical basis for it. In the second century, the elders and bishops were differentiated. In the late second century, you have one bishop overseeing a group of bishops. So you see the hierarchical structure beginning to occur. In the third century, the priesthood and sacrifices. Elders come to be seen as sacrificing priests. And, oh, back up. And the primacy of the Bishop of Rome asserted. The Bishop of Rome began to be held a little bit higher than some of the others. Early 4th century metropolitan bishops, the ones in the bigger cities, just like we have today, because there were big population centers, began to ascend over the local bishops. Late 4th century, special honor given to Bishop of Rome, Alexandria, Antioch, Constantinople, and Jerusalem. They were called the patriarchs. In fact, the Eastern Church still uses a patriarchal system. They have a group of bishops as opposed to the single papacy, the single pope that the Western Roman Church has. They have a council of bishops. In the mid-5th century, the supremacy of Rome, Leo I claimed authority over the whole church and basis of succession. And basically, when you get to Leo III, they separate not only the church, but they're also separating the secular government as well.
And that's a really important theological shift in the 5th century. It's the beginning of what's called apostolic succession. And it took 400 years for this to develop. It's one thing to say the New Testament specifies these offices in the church. And then over 400 years, it becomes a little bit corrupted because it seems like they put more tiers in the offices than the Bible does. But they're still, up until this point, just making the argument that, look, the New Testament has offices of deacon, elder, and bishop. And so we're going to put people into those offices. Now when you get here, something changes. It's not just these are biblical offices. It is the people who sit in the office of bishop are direct descendants. They have been handed that office, not descendants by blood, but spiritual descendants of the person who held it before them. So it's not, I'm a bishop in the same way that this guy was a bishop and in the same way that guy. It is, I'm a bishop with the exact same authority as the guy before me had, as the guy before him, and oh, by the way, Peter.